Good evening. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I am Dr. Hillary Seligman, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco Center for Vulnerable Populations, and your moderator for today's program. Dr. James Madeira is the Chief Executive Officer of the American Medical Association and an accomplished academic physician, medical scientist, and administrator. He is particularly well known for his work as an academic pathologist, formerly serving as the president of the American Board of Pathology. He is a premier authority on gastrointestinal disease and epithelial cell biology, garnering both national and international awards for his work. Dr. Madeira was a professor and chair of pathology and laboratory medicine at the Emory University School of Medicine, and then went on to become dean at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine, and served as CEO of the University of Chicago Medical Center, bringing together the university's biomedical research, teaching, and clinical activities. Dr. Madeira earned his medical degree from Hahnemann Medical College in Philadelphia and completed his residency at New England Deaconess Hospital in Boston. Welcome to San Francisco, Dr. Madeira.
Thank you. Well, good evening, and it's really great to be here in San Francisco, the nation's epicenter of innovation, technology, and design. And I'm delighted to represent the American Medical Association, an organization which, like this Commonwealth Club, has a long and iconic history. Founded in 1847, the AMA spent its initial half century stamping out the rampant quackery that once characterized medicine in the U.S., and related to that, creating standards for medical education didn't exist at the time, and also developing the first code of medical ethics. Now, leaping forward till today, we find ourselves with different but not lesser challenges. I'd like to first recognize four key facts about healthcare in the United States as context. First, it's really expensive. $3 trillion a year. It's rapidly approaching 20% of our GDP. If we floated the U.S. healthcare system out on an island, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. And about a third of this spending is attributed to waste. We spend more per capita than other advanced countries, and the outcomes don't follow. The average life expectancy in the U.S. is just over 79. That ranks 43rd. National, worldwide. Simultaneously, though, we also spend the least of all OECD countries on safety net programs and early childhood support. Many think that low spending in the safety net may relate in part to our higher spending in healthcare. Now, that's first covering the money. The second fact is that our disease burden has really dramatically shifted. In the last half century, we've moved proportionately from episodic to chronic disease. You know, episodes that used to kill us now have been converted to manageable chronic states. And yet, the structure of training for physicians remains largely as it was a century ago. And on top of this, we provide insufficient resources for disease prevention. Third fact is that there's a tsunami of experimentation in healthcare delivery technology, 3D printing of tissues, digital approaches, health apps, and more. There are as many as 60,000 devices and health apps now directly available to consumers. Yet, most of those don't meet standards of being validated or evidence-based, or actionable. And most don't connect in an effective way with the overall health record. We need to separate the medically useful from the merely entertaining. And by connecting the useful to the health record, we leverage the physician-patient relationship for better health in our nation. The fourth contextual fact, and last, is the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as a critical fact in healthcare today. Now, the AMA has been very supportive of the Affordable Care Act for the simple reason that it expands coverage. This is also a sea change, and given the size and complexity of our healthcare system, it shouldn't be any surprise that we would sense that some improvements need to be made. However, the overarching fact is that those lacking health insurance live sicker and die younger. And I hope you're not surprised to learn that the AMA happens to be strongly against our citizens being sicker and dying younger. So with those four facts as our challenge, I'll just outline the AMA's actions. Our long-term strategic plan, established in 2012, aspires to accomplish three big things. First, create the medical school of the future. Second, create tools and resources to help physicians better thrive. For example, working toward advancements that ease the disconnected, confusing, often counterproductive administrative demands currently typical of a physician's work environment. And thirdly, to shape a better and new approach for our nation's chronic disease burden. And we refer to these as our moonshot challenges. And I just want to briefly now review progress on each. Challenge number one, for all of societal's advancements over the last century, the way we train and educate young doctors has actually little changed. You know, obviously, each new discovery is thrown into the educational mix, but the overall structure of the curriculum and its focus largely remains captive of the first part of the 20th century. The result? There's a tremendous gap between how physicians in the U.S. are educated and the way care actually needs to be delivered in this rapidly changing environment. And that gap widens every year. So the AMA set out to transform medical education in this country by creating and also providing funding for a diverse network of medical schools, unifying them and inspire them to think bigger. This initiative now includes 32, almost a quarter, of our country's medical schools and helps them innovate, share practices, and push the boundaries of traditional medical education. The consortium comes together frequently, and subsets of the schools bring different areas of curricular innovation, which when you aggregate these different areas, you can sort of see then a vision of what the medical school of the future might look like. One that measures competency, one that responds to the need of chronic disease burden by attending to team-based care, continuity, more outpatient exposure, one that adopts new technologies for education and creates new fields in medical science. These are schools that will do more than simply prepare young doctors to take care of patients. They will ready physicians for a lifetime of training and learning in the context of enormous ongoing change, prepare physicians to take leadership roles in medicine, exploring the most innovative ways to care for patients, populations, communities. In short, they will create the physician workforce that's needed to satisfy the new and different needs of the 21st century. Now, the second challenge many of you probably have sensed in interacting with your own physician. Our world is connected like never before, and yet what is referred to as our health system in reality is a non-system. It's a fragmented, tangled web of inefficient, ineffective, non-connected technology that frustrates physicians and undermines patient care. A leading example, the current state of the electronic health records. Now, this is where all of your important data is stored. medical history, medications, allergies, etc. The electronic health record was created to bring medicine into the digital age. Yet more often than not, here in 2016, your physician can't send your digital record to a specialist at another site. Your records are often opaque, even to you. It's not easy to incorporate results when they come back from the lab into these records. The clinical data your physician depends upon is poorly organized. And as you'll recall, you are asked for the same information over and over and over again. And your physician spends hours every day just inputting your data into this clunky electronic record. In the emergency room, it takes a physician 16 clicks to order one aspirin. Our recent studies show that what physicians find most satisfying, and this is most satisfying hands down above all else, nothing else comes close, what they find most satisfying is one-on-one time with their patients. And that's the same thing we all want. Another AMA study reveals that on average, your physician spends 50% of her time on the keyboard, only a third interacting with her patients, and 2 more hours every evening at home completing data entry. Hours that used to be spent studying the latest updates or decompressing with the family. American physicians are now the most expensive data entry workforce this planet has ever seen. And what a waste and how frustrating. In response, the AMA is creating interactive web-based digital tools to provide for the practice of medicine and free more time for patient interactions. We're also battling for improved electronic records that ease data use needed at the point of care. No one wants to go back to paper. What we do want are digital tools that work as they do in every other industry except healthcare. Now, in addition, payers have differing sets of documentation requirements, and practices deal with many types of insurance contracts. So here's an example. If 10 identical patients are covered by 10 different insurance plans, there will be 10 different sets of documentation requirements of the physician. This is time-consuming, it's confusing, and has absolutely no health benefit to our nation. Thus, we're pushing to simplify a variety of duplicative and contradictory administrative processes. The third and final challenge faced in our long-term strategic plan is that of chronic disease. Chronic disease accounts for more than 85% of that $3 trillion annual healthcare spend. Just two diseases, type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, cost the nation more than $500 billion each year. Some 80 million Americans today are living with high blood pressure, and that's the number one risk factor for debilitating conditions like heart attack, stroke, and kidney failure. That's why the AMA launched an initiative to measure blood pressure and do it accurately, act rapidly, and partner with patients, families, and communities to control blood pressure and prevent heart disease. We're now extending this activity in a partnership with the American Heart Association. Additionally, some 86 million adult Americans, roughly 1 in 3, I'm sorry to say that's a third of this room, are currently living with prediabetes, a condition that, if ignored, frequently converts to type 2 diabetes. And the vast majority of those that are prediabetic don't know it. To confront this, the AMA has partnered with the Centers for Disease Control, the American Diabetes Association, and community organizations to identify those with prediabetes and get them into programs that prevent this from becoming type 2 diabetes. These diabetes prevention programs have been demonstrated to work. They save money, and patients better participate when recommended to do so by their physician. Some 22 million Americans above age 65 have prediabetes, And Medicare saves more than $2,500 annually for each person that completes a prevention program. Thus, Congress, with our strong support, is moving toward reimbursement of these sensible preventative programs. Similarly, our own research shows that employers save an equally substantial amount for every case of diabetes that is prevented among employees. So to help business owners understand what this means to their bottom line and to reinforce the importance of preventative care, the AMA created an online calculator available at our website. And then finally, the AMA, in partnership with the CDC, the American Diabetes Association, and the Ad Council, recently launched a public service campaign on television, radio, in print, online, urging people to get screened for prediabetes. The site is doihaveprediabetes.org. These three challenge areas, creating the medical school of the future, helping physicians build more thriving practices, and identifying new holistic approaches for our chronic disease burden, these three moonshots also share something else. In each of these, we find many gaps to be filled, solvable problems, white spaces, begging for innovative solutions. We've studied the utility of products and services produced by physicians, by the private sector, and these, I have to say, routinely have a solid theoretical use case basis. However, they're often not well informed as to the practical, granular level needs of workflow and patient care. And they're often not well informed of the variations that occur across different markets and practice types. Variations that would require either flexibility of the product or a product that comes in a small number of flavors. In other words, what we're finding out from physicians is that the tools that are currently being thrown over the transom to them often don't work so well. Entrepreneurs need physician knowledge to better optimize what is produced in the care setting. So the AMA has launched a variety of approaches to seed this knowledge at the very conception of entrepreneurial ideas. Now, here are some examples taken from what has developed over the last 2 years into what I've been calling our AMA innovation ecosystem. First, I've already touched on digital tools that we ourselves have produced, as well as the fact that we're interacting with several organizations and companies toward better solutions. As another example, we've partnered with a Chicago-based healthcare technology incubator called Matter, now housing more than 120 healthcare startup companies, as well as the AMA's own interaction space within Matter, a space used to better inform entrepreneurs at the origin of innovative ideas. In fact, some of the entrepreneurs have told us that they've moved their startup companies to Matter because of the AMA's presence, sometimes from out of town. But perhaps the crown jewel in this AMA ecosystem is the innovation studio we launched during the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference past January right here in San Francisco. Located just south of Market on 7th Street, the studio is named Health 2047. Health 2047, both recognizing our vision, what we believe healthcare should look like by the mid-portion of the 21st century, but also 2047 in recognizing it's the AMA's 200th anniversary. We're the founding investor in Health 2047, an independent for-profit studio, organized as such to be permissive to the culture of this most creative and innovative part of the country. The goal is simple. We have an asset of deep AMA knowledge base. This includes content experts in virtually every healthcare microvertical, from pharmacogenomics to ethics to regulation. This AMA knowledge asset also includes our ongoing analysis of physician practices across multiple markets. So think of it as a serial full-body scan of our nation's physician practices. We've also identified many gaps and needs in search of solutions. So the goal is to take these knowledge assets and bridge them to the rich technology and innovation environment here in the Bay Area. The approach will be one of iteration and design by multifunctional teams, taking carefully crafted ideas around healthcare needs and creating prototypes, which after testing with physicians, if they're proven worthy, they exit and are further developed. The multifunctional teams in Health 2047 include engineers, coders, physicians, product developers, anthropologists, behavioral economics, and game designers, as well as others. Health 2047 will work on the gaps, those white spaces I mentioned, but will also be able to co-develop with industry more optimized products for healthcare and for efficient and effective practices. Work within the AMA ecosystem has recently revealed another nuanced but important conceptual flaw in the production of healthcare goods and services. Many industry approaches have a skewed view of healthcare, viewing it as kind of a linear, monolithic manufacturing process, whereas today's disease burdens require more of a systems engineering approach attuned to geographic and other variation. So there's much work to be done, but our pathway is clear and our sight line is most definitely forward. The AMA stamped out rampant quackery in medicine in the mid-1800s. In the early 21st century, the AMA is taking advantage of our position in this rapidly changing healthcare environment to create the education of the future, to combat the growing scourge of chronic disease, and to allow physicians to do what they most covet, spend time face-to-face with their patients. However, we can't accomplish these goals without engaging the world of innovation, the world that provides solutions to the problems and fills the gaps that currently vex us. It's the combination of the work in our strategic plan and the AMA's innovation ecosystem that will allow us to satisfy our mission. Our mission, constant over the last 170 years, to promote the art and science of medicine and the betterment of public health. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. There is clearly a lot of interest in the things you said, as I can tell by the sheer volume of questions that already have been filtered up to me. So let me start by asking you about single-party payers in the U.S. In theory, or some people argue, that a single-payer system could both reduce administrative burdens and allow a shifting of costs towards preventive care, both things that you just mentioned in your comments as being things that the American Medical Association is really working hard to try to achieve. What is the AMA's official position here, and what are your personal thoughts about this?
So I should make it clear from the start is that we're a nonpartisan organization. And so when it comes to topics that are going to be decided in a political way, we wait until we see what the decision of the nation of Congress will be. But our goals and our trajectory are always the same. It's coverage, improved health, lower cost, better education, and whether it's a single-payer system or it's a complex system as we now have, that's a political decision. We work with all parties and constituencies toward these what we view to be higher ends.
Mm-hmm. Great. So following up on that point then, what are the healthcare issues that you hope our presidential candidates will be talking about as they travel the country over the next 6 months?
So one is coverage. And another is tools that work in the healthcare system. we have a dramatic need for interoperability and data sharing across what are now siloed areas of data, where our son has a chronic disease. I was CEO of University of Chicago's health system, and he came back to town for his colonoscopy around the holidays, and his physician, a very well-known physician in that area, had moved from one academic system to another there in Chicago, and it was as though no information existed on him. And we just have to be better than that. And it's even more acute now that we, maybe you could even get away with that when you're dealing with episodic disease. With chronic disease that requires all this continuity and handoff, it's just unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. You bring up a really important issue. I think a lot of people feel as if the electronic health record is going to be a panacea in terms of both administrative costs and flow of information, but clearly it hasn't been the panacea that people hoped for. How do you think the broader physician community should be advocating for EHR improvement and ways to make electronic health records work better, not just for themselves, but for patients as well?
So I think this sheds a light on the how physicians have to be involved at the conception of an idea. And I think we weren't in this area. So the electronic health records were built on top of something that existed as a precursor, so-called practice management systems. And they ended up being built in a way that's actually pretty good for claims and billing and risk mitigation. But I think everyone in this room probably envisioned them as being the clinical tool that would allow and improve healthcare. And it's the data entry and extraction in an organized way that is so weak. And then on top of that, the problem that I mentioned of interoperability. So physicians being involved, as we are now in Matter, Health 2047, for the next generation of tool that will be important, to be there at the conception so that it's crafted with the granular knowledge of what is actually needed around the patient and the patient-physician interface.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the advent of big data will help solve this healthcare interoperability problem?
Well, what we need from the big data are the small data that are needed at the point of care, organized in a sensible way. One project that I didn't mention that is a large project in the AMA that's just kicking off right now is it takes the view that healthcare, unlike almost any other industry, has been built on the understanding of inputs rather than outputs. Every other industry thinks of outputs. The automobile industry thinks of a car as the output, and then you go back through the inputs and see the various ways of getting there. Can you use less steel to make a better product? We now are taking the various procedural, diagnostic, therapeutic coding systems, creating a relational ontology, so it's kind of a tree of life relationship. If you have a relational ontology, it can be probed by machine learning. But what we need to construct is a functional ontology, because it's that output that we really are interested in. And I think as part of that functional ontology, particularly over the next decade, patient-reported functions are going to be so important. Because sometimes what we in the medical field think about, this measurement and that, patients could care less about. Patients are interested in functioning as they did before with their family, going to work. Can they hold their grandchild? These are things that are the important outputs, probably ultimately, of our health system.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that you bring it up that way. And there was a question about this focus on medical education and electronic health records and prevention. Where does the focus on quality come in and on patient-oriented outcomes?
Yeah, so exactly in the new medical education curriculum, we have created a new field in medical science called medical health systems science. First textbook in this area will
will publish later this calendar year. And it touches on this issue of looking at medicine not as kind of linear manufacturing, but as a system, systems engineering problem. And that touches on both quality and I would say it touches on the fact that the contours of medicine and medicine services in this country have changed in the last half century without us really being embedded in that. And what I mean by that is, if you ask a systems engineer what is important in understanding the systems, that person will say you have to understand the boundary of the system. And the boundary of our system with episodic disease used to be our clinics and healthcare centers. Now with chronic disease that plays out in the community, with behavioral aspects that need to be attended to, the outline of our health system, if we're thinking of it in a system engineering way, are the borders of the United States. It's no longer a medical center or a clinic. And we have to begin to think about how community organizations, employers, payers, all interact in this system. We, with the CDC, are scaling such a project in the state of Michigan currently. We have 40 organizations, YMCAs, other community organizations, all thinking about how one organizes as a non-siloed healthcare system, as a nation, and thinking about the quality of life that we have.
It's interesting that you end there. We have a couple of questions that really speak to these silos. One, asking whether the shift in medical education towards residency programs that are more siloed discourages work across specialties.
Yeah.
And the other, talking about how practice is shifting towards an emphasis on team-based care, but we may or may not be teaching our new physicians and healthcare providers how to function within teams that work across silos. Can you talk about those issues?
So in our consortium of 32 schools, the AMA Medical School Consortium, team-based care and thinking about continuity for chronic care in communities is one of the front and center topics. And what I'm happy to say is something called the ACGME, the American College of Graduate Medical Education, that looks over the internship and residency part of the training, are now taking derivative aspects of our medical school work and beginning to apply it to residency programs. How do you think about this in a residency program? So you can start seeing the wave moving out from the medical school. But this is exactly what has to occur. It has to be team-based. There has to be data sharing. The big data have to yield the small data that are important in an effective way.
In addition to teaching our medical students and residents about team-based care and working outside of their silo, there's a lot of questions about things that traditionally have been left out of medical education. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this focuses on nutrition, but some also focuses on very highly innovative and new areas of research, like technical aspects of genomics. I think the general trend in these questions is there are so many new things that medical students should be taught. Where should we be putting our emphasis, and how will the medical school of the future address those many, many things?
Well, I think what has happened in the last quarter century or so is we've moved from a medical knowledge base that could be crammed into someone's very bright head to a knowledge base that now exceeds that capacity. And so part of the medical education approach is to recognize how to find data, how to use the right data, how to access and manipulate big data, but more importantly, how to use each member of this healthcare team in the most effective way. So, one would imagine in the future that a team that is focused on primary care, for example, would have nutritional components experts in that team, would have people that are expert at genomic interpretations as part of that team. It's also true that some of the primary medical homes, as we convert acute disease into chronic disease, are probably going to be specialties. Again, my son has a gastrointestinal disease. His primary care is a gastroenterologist. But the gastroenterologist needs to be supplemented by a team that includes nutrition and some of these other aspects as well.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Dr. James Madera, CEO of the American Medical Association. I am Dr. Hilary Seligman, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco Center for Vulnerable Populations, and your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. So, Dr. Madera, you brought up the topic of primary care and integration of team-based care. Can you comment on the severe shortage of primary care physicians in the U.S. and how the AMA is involved in helping to address this shortage?
Yes, so this shortage of care that is predicted to be not only in primary care, but actually some of the specialties as well, is being addressed in first by expanding the capacity of our medical schools, number of medical schools, as well as the capacity. But, you know, in some of the data that I mentioned from our own recent studies, when you take physicians and you use them as data entry workforce, and you only have a third of their time interfacing with patients, some of the workforce need may well be covered by using what we have much more effectively and efficiently, decreasing administrative burden, having electronic tools that work, decreasing the frustration. I should also say that the frustration and the burnout is really now quite high in physicians. And you see that talked about in almost all of the lay media. It's true if you measured it. It's also true that if you just delay physicians' retirements by 2 years, that you actually fill in part of that projected workforce need. And the way of delaying a retirement 2 years is by making someone's job enjoyable. We have, I think, as a nation, stumbled into a misunderstanding of incentivization of physicians. So our federal programs now give financial rewards, financial penalties, and classical economics, which suggests that those are appropriate ways of affecting people's behavior. On the other hand, if one moves from classical economics to behavioral economics tells us that in cognitive complex fields, if you want to incentivize someone, you use their intrinsic drivers. We know what the intrinsic driver of the physician is. It's to spend time with their patient. And so it was interesting in this regard. Kolstad at Wharton published a paper in the American Economic Review a year and a half ago, where he took two groups of cardiovascular surgeons. One he gave a financial reward to for improving an aspect of quality. The other group, he said, what do you need for your practice? What do you aspire to that you think would make your practice more satisfying? And they said, if we could have real-time feedback of data and compare ourselves. And that's all they asked for. That group, where they used the intrinsic driver of incentivization, increased quality 400% greater than the group that had the financial reward. So I think we also have to think about how we incentivize this group. We know what the drivers are for behavior. Let's use those.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we hear in the world of primary care a lot of grumblings about the lower reimbursement rate for primary care physicians as compared to specialists. And the AMA has long taken a role in helping to advocate for reimbursement rates. Do you think that increasing reimbursement rates for primary care visits and procedures would help address this problem at all?
Yeah, in our own studies done in collaboration, it was a collaboration between AMA and RAND Health, done in multiple markets, boots on the ground, multiple practices, qualitative social science. The financial component was slightly different than we had at first imagined. And it was people wanted security, predictability, and they didn't want their financial support to go downward. And I think everyone in any kind of work in the United States would aspire to the same thing. And we are in a system now of rapid change that destabilizes that a little bit because fiats will shift in an unpredictable way, payments in one direction or another. But again, I think that if one can stabilize as any workforce would want, have this workforce feel secure, non-threatened, but then the big driver is, what do I do during the day? Am I with my patients? And do I feel like I've done a good job at the end of the day because I had time with my patients? Or do I feel like 50 administrators are yelling at me to check boxes? And I think that is the real deleterious thing that physicians face currently. In fact, physicians actually use that quote in our studies. During my day, I feel like I'm being yelled at by 50 people continually, checking boxes, doing administrative, 10 different insurance forms that differ with every payer, adds no value to the system. That is really, that's what produces burnout.
I identify with that a lot as a primary care provider. Yeah. I also have received a lot of questions that really address the physician's role outside the office and in the community. And a lot of these center around what role physicians and the AMA should play in hot button issues like nutrition, different ideas about stopping eating meat or stopping eating less sodium, less sugar. What can we as physicians, or what should we as physicians, be advocating for in issues such as nutrition? And does the AMA speak to any of these issues?
Yes. Yeah, so I talked about three mission areas where we're devoting enormous resources because we think that they would have impact that would be global on our health system. That's not to say that we don't pay attention to these other issues as they arise as well. So, for example, we strongly supported and encouraged the added sugar legislation from the FDA recently passed for nutrition labels. We were actively involved with the federal government and the CDC in the Ebola crisis. We're similarly involved with Zika. However, we don't try to compete with the CDC. We talk to our other stakeholders, CDC, learn what they need from us, and then we try to construct that, and then we also assemble information from multiple sites on our Zika website, for example, that we currently put up. So we pay attention to these areas because that's the nature of medicine in the United States. It's somewhat unpredictable. However, we do have these longer-term sort of 10, 20-year projects to transform the health system as well.
So you work very collaboratively with the CDC and other government agencies,
absolutely,
it sounds like. Can you comment specifically on the FDA and how you see the FDA in terms of really being a potential barrier to medical advances, or in particular to the pace of innovation and the pace of getting drugs out to market.
Yeah. So the FDA has a difficult job, and in my estimation, they do it quite well. We have to recognize some of the origin of the orientation of the FDA in this country. Many, many years ago, there was a drug called thalidomide, you'll all recall. It was used widely in Europe, and there were many birth defects. The FDA, through an abundance of caution, had restricted that drug from being used in pregnant women in the United States. And from that event, what was learned is that by being very attentive to risk like that, that, you know, the nation could win. Now, it's also simultaneously true, you hear from multiple quarters saying, well, you know, I wish the processes could be faster, the approvals take too long, stifles innovation. You will hear that comment until there's another thalidomide that is not blocked by the FDA, and then, you know, the arrow will swing in the opposite direction. So like any other agency that has this very complex, important role, it requires a lot of delicate balance.
Another issue that the FDA has a lot of responsibility for is drug commercials. Does the AMA have any concerns about commercials that target consumers, encourage them to ask doctors for drugs that may or may not be appropriate?
We do have a concern about that. We think it encourages sometimes the overuse, misuse of drugs, and we do not support the direct-to-consumer advertising.
Great.
It's, you know, it's one of these things you have to be, you know, really careful. I remember being at, when I was in my position at the University of Chicago, I had a problem with a knee, and I had to have something done to my knee. And the orthopod, who was just a great friend, I went to see and was fabulous, sketched out on a piece of paper what was being done to my knee and how I should exercise. I took the piece of paper out, and I realized, you know, walking down the hall, there was the name of a drug on that piece of paper. And the drug was actually something that was prescribed for me completely appropriately. But if I didn't know the surgeon and I didn't know that this was the right drug, what might have I have thought? It might have destabilized my confidence in that exposure. And I think that's something that we don't need in our system.
Clearly, this also has implications for how we allocate our healthcare dollars. And there are many people, you included at the podium, who talked about the misallocation, perhaps, of dollars away from preventive healthcare. There is a lot of healthcare dollars that are spent at the end of life, often in the ICU. How do you think about the potential need to draw away from acute health care in order to fund preventive health care? How do we talk about withdrawing care in a way that is more patient-centered and cost-effective? And how do we have these conversations in the context of a very politicized health care debate?
Yeah, so the death panel question. Let me put it this way. I think that what evidence and experience has shown is that if we have more attention toward end-of-life care and we recognize that ultimately families are going to want to handle this in their own particular way, and we have planning for that end-of-life care well in advance, so the individual, the family, has wrestled with this, what they want to do, how they want to do it, you find in practice that there is less complexity and less cost at the end of life. If you do the sort of the humane thing, I would recommend to everyone Atul Gawande's book On Being Mortal that deals with this in a very elegant and, in my view, right way. It's not something for the last minute. And, physicians shouldn't always think that, you know, death is a loss. It depends on what the patient and the family wishes to experience in that end-of-life period.
So like death panels, which you bring up.
Foolishly.
Women's health issues have also gotten highly politicized in the last few decades. How do physicians push back against those politics?
Yeah, so I think in general, you know, in our society, whether it be the type of individual, the kind of treatment that they would get has to be stabilized and standardized. You know, when the AIDS epidemic began with sweeping the country, people that were HIV infected were treated as a population that should not be touched or be kept at length in some way. And one of the things that we're very proud of the AMA is we took a leadership position then and said, no, that's wrong. Everyone's a citizen. Everyone deserves the same amount of respect, treatment, and access. And we fought hard for that and did so successfully. And I think whether you put the name on it as a child, AIDS, a ethnicity, the answer is always the same. It's, you know, everyone is a citizen. They're equal in the eyes of the healthcare system, and they deserve access and the best possible treatment.
Another area that has become highly politicized and to many physicians feels instead like a relationship between themselves and their patient is the aid in dying issue, which has come to the forefront recently in California. Does the AMA take a position on physician assistance at the end of life?
Yeah, so we think that that is not a position for physicians to be in. We think that it undercuts the security of the rest of the patients might have in that position, and that the physicians should be attentive to cultural aspects of end of life, but should not be a direct participant in ending life. We think that just doesn't make sense for the field, and it may destabilize how others think about their physician.
So those are a lot of very specific issues. I think in the last 10 or 15 minutes, there are a number of questions that take us back up to the 10,000-foot uh-huh. view. And I'm going to ask you first to use a crystal ball and tell us what you think the Affordable Care Act will look like and will have done over the next 5 to 10 years, and how we prepare ourselves for those changes.
Yeah, so let me mention a couple of things that the Affordable Care Act has already done, because I think we will see a trajectory from this. For the first time, I think, in measured history, our uninsured rate is below 10% now. We have millions of patients that have coverage that didn't before. One cannot deny someone coverage based on a pre-existing condition. Folks can keep their child up to the age of 26 on their own insurance. I think another thing that the Affordable Care Act did in establishing the so-called Innovation Center is it gave a signal not only to what happens in Medicare, Medicaid, and the federal government. It gave a signal broadly to the nation that it's okay to do experimentation. And there might be experiments that the federal government follows that come from the private sector. And so we see this explosion of innovation and experimentation. It just has to be directed better, I think, as I pointed out by our work with Health 2047 and the rest of our innovation ecosystem. So I think that will continue. Now, a major component of the Affordable Care Act that will begin to kick in the next couple of years, starting January next year, is a shift from fee-for-service kind of reimbursement to value-based reimbursement. I think that's also a sea change in our system. I wish a couple of things. I wish we were further along in understanding and being able to define those outputs, because you really need to know what the output is to judge what the value is. And I think we have to be careful that it's not going to be one size fits all. You know, what medical problems exist and the way they're approached in downtown Manhattan, New York, is going to be different than Manhattan, Kansas. And, you know, there might be, as Paul Simon might say, there may be 50 ways to lose your disease. And and some of those may have value, some not, but the ones that have value may be fit for certain geographical domains. So I think if we get to a more systemic approach, with data are open and shared, available, we have tools and digital tools that actually work and improve practice. We have continuity because we have this problem of chronic disease where you need continuity. And an example of that is, telemedicine and MinuteClinics. So what you can't do is add another fragment. And what a lot of these elements aren't quite good at yet is defining how they intercalate into the treatment plan and the record in an efficient way. You as a primary care physician don't want 40 more sheets of paper in your inbox. You know, you want efficiently organized, actionable data around your patient. So we have to make sure that in an area, in a healthcare system that's characterized by a major flaw being fragmentation, that we don't start adding more fragments.
So you started to talk about not just healthcare, but the management of healthcare. What effect do you think the digital revolution will have on the management of healthcare?
Well, I think it's potentially huge and positive if it's organized the same way. And by that I mean if it does the same thing in healthcare that it does in every other industry, which there's no reason why it shouldn't. We frankly do have players that would be disadvantaged if we did have more connected health, products that are proprietary, that their integrity depends on being disconnected. Andy Slavitt, the acting director of Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, sends a strong message that if your business is in disconnected healthcare, you might consider a different business.
Yeah, we have some questions that really express frustration with insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, both on behalf of physicians and patients. From this 10,000-foot view, do you have ideas for how we advocate to change that system? And I'm going to say specifically so that it's more patient-centered, because we have talked a lot about the needs to make the system work for physicians, to prevent physician burnout, to increase efficiency. How do we make it more patient-centered?
I think we start with the education of the physician that then interacts with these other stakeholders. So as an example, I will go to a lecture hall at a medical school. It's one of our top-ranked medical schools. Done this a few times. And at one point during the lecture, I'll say, does anyone in the auditorium disagree with the following? That medical education should be patient-focused, quality-centered, and team-based. Not a single hand goes up. Everyone agrees with that. And then I say, does anyone in the auditorium think that our current top 20 ranked medical schools are described by that? And everyone laughs. So it's really reforming how we as providers, I think about these other stakeholders and how they enter the system and get it in our heads that it's patient-centered, quality-focused, team-based. The other thing I would say is that it's always easy to look at pharmaceutical industry, you know, FDA, the insurers, point to them, and it does nothing but degrade the ability to move forward. So we have to interact with these folks. Rich Umbenstock, who was then CEO of the American Hospital Association, and I had a conversation. We said, you know, we need to get our leadership together for a day and a half in the same room. And so we planned this meeting. It turned out to be a great meeting. Had defined principles, American Medical, American Hospital. And we talked about how to begin the session. And I said, well, Rich, when was the last time? Well, why don't we pick up, see where we left off from the last meeting? Two organizations hadn't sat down together for 35 years. So we're interacting with pharmaceuticals. We're interacting with the insurers. And, you know, I think a way of making this feel like more of a system and more of an effective output is a way of not doing that is not talking to each other. We have to open those lines of communication as we've never done before, and we're in the process of doing that.
Many people, particularly in safety net settings, which you brought up in your prepared remarks as being particularly underfunded and underaddressed, feel as if providing patient-centered care will require physicians to have a more prominent role in addressing the social determinants of health. How does the AMA see the physician's responsibility in addressing these issues?
Yeah, so this, our new science in health systems science is actually focused on these problems. And the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Medicine, actually also wrestled with how do we measure the quality of the outcomes when we have disparities and other things, chronic disease in our society. And what we'd had in our healthcare system was this view of the so-called, you know, triple aim, better health, better healthcare, lower cost. And then distant under that were granular quality measures. And it didn't track so well up to the triple aim. And so an intermediate layer called vital signs was created by National Academy of Medicine. And there are about 12 buckets there. And if you look at those 12 buckets and what they begin to measure, you start realizing that it's not all in communities, it's not all in physicians, it's on all of us. Physicians, in my view, cannot be held responsible for high school graduation rates. High school graduation rates are an important determinant of health in our country. So everyone has something to bring to bear. Food deserts in our urban areas, where we were talking earlier, the south side of Chicago. You say, you know, you have to eat vegetables. You say, well, you know, I eat lots of vegetables. You say, but, you know, you have this hypertension that's hard to control. And, you know, let's see what you eat. And you see a can of preserved vegetables with an incredibly high salt content. And why is that? It's because there's no fresh produce within walking distance of this person's. Physicians cannot be responsible for that. So we have to have shared responsibility as a nation. Once we lose the contours of healthcare as being the clinics and now it's the borders of the United States, folks, we're all in this together. And we have shared responsibility.
We've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and it will be a follow-up to that question, which is, There was a time in which physicians were known for being leaders in their community in broad areas of public health. And we see that less and less often now. Physicians are often not engaged in their communities, not community advocates. Is that something that should change? And if so, how do we move physicians to become more engaged in issues of public health?
Yeah, I actually, on this one, I might disagree with the premise. And in fact, let me lay out another view. So there is a view among physicians that are, sadly, my age, you know, 60, you know, plus, that you hear spoken on. And they say, you know, these young physicians, they don't, you know, they don't work 80-hour weeks or 70-hour weeks like we used to. You know, they're soft. And, you know, what's going on with that? And yet, when you look at our younger physicians, how you find them spending that time outside of practice that used to be totally devoted to practice is engaging in community work, engaging with families, engaging with churches or religious affiliations and baseball teams. And so we have to get away from this past where you know, was once described as I knew this community that we're all born as humans, but now they're physicians. And to a point where physicians do engage the community, and I actually see that happening. And in fact, I saw that in our medical school as well. You know, our medical students, not infrequently, would take a year off, say, between college and medical school. And older faculty were sometimes thinking, you know, these people are soft, what's wrong with them? You know, we would never think of doing that. But you look at what they were doing, and they were, you know, in communities that were underserved. They were learning about those communities. They were learning about public health. So I actually think we have a pretty good trajectory there. I do wish sometimes that we had more MDs who had an aspiration to be in government, in agencies, in business, because this is a fifth of our economy, and it's very complicated. And we need that specialty knowledge evenly distributed.
Well, on that note, I would like to extend our thanks to Dr. James Madera, CEO of the American Medical Association. I am Dr. Hillary Seligman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.